All right, welcome back, everybody. It's Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. One of the most iconic television programs in history is The Twilight Zone, a show that originally aired from 1959 to 1964. Now, the program followed in the tradition of earlier TV shows like Tales of Tomorrow, Science Fiction Theater, as well as radio's The Weird Circle, Dimension X, X-1, and the radio work of Serling's heroes, Norman Corwin and Arch Obler. Now, it was a mix of drama, psychological thriller, fantasy, science fiction, suspense, and horror every week for five seasons. Now, after 156 episodes, the Writers Guild of America recognized The Twilight Zone to be one of the best-written television series of all time. Serling was posthumously inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1985 and the Science Fiction Hall of Fame in 2008. He had countless Peabody, Emmy, and Golden Globe Awards. And now Rod Serling's daughter, Anne, she's a writer herself, joins us tonight to talk about her father's legacy. It's amazing, Anne, to be able to understand and at the same time celebrate the success of this amazing television series.
Yes, it's pretty stunning, isn't it? And no one would have been more surprised than my father that people are still talking about it.
I think all the way back then when those shows were produced, nobody really knew, you know, especially in the late 50s, early 60s, what kind of longevity some of these shows would eventually have. And the networks, you know, after only having three, four channels back then, the variety that's out there, that this show is still a standout.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was difficult to even get it going, you know, with the way censors were and sponsors. So it was tricky. It was very difficult to get them aired, and which is why actually my father launched into The Twilight Zone, because he wanted to write some meaningful scripts. And prior to that, he'd written things that, you know, were blue-lined, and it was just very difficult. For instance, he wrote a script about Emmett Till, and it was very, very difficult to talk about, you know, issues that were so relevant.
Yeah.
And he finally wrote a script about Emmett Till that was called A Town Has Turned to Dust, and by the time the censors were done with it, he said his script had turned to dust.
I bet. He battled that all along, didn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah, and then, you know, the sponsors, it was so crazy. He wrote a show where the Chrysler building showed in the skyline, and it had to be blacked out because the sponsors were Ford. You know, so there was all that pressure, too, from sponsors.
He was inspired at a very early age, though, from some of those Pulp Fiction stories that were out there. I mean, that's what kind of got his blood rushing a little bit. You know, those stories from Norman Corwin and Arch Obler, you know, two of the best writers in the industry. And they took some risk, too, on radio. And I think that's what your father really admired.
Yeah, absolutely. He was also a great fan of Poe's and Lovecraft.
Now, right out of high school, he joined the Army, where he served in World War II with awards that included the Purple Heart and the Bronze Star. And out of the war, he studied literature and started right away in radio. While he was at college, he managed the school's radio broadcasting workshop.
He did. Originally, when he got out of the war, he really didn't know what he wanted to do. And he went to Antioch because his brother had gone there, and he was planning to major in physical education because he liked working with kids, but he was so traumatized by the war, as, you know, any vet is, that he turned to language and literature because, as he said, he had to get it off his chest. He had to get it out of his gut. And the writing, you know, proved cathartic. And, you know, he did start at the radio show where he wrote and acted out everything he was writing.
He did everything. It was kind of a great learning curve for him to kind of touch and feel everything that was about radio at the time.
Right. And actually, while he was a student at Antioch and working on in the radio program, he wrote a script for Dr. Christian, and he won second prize. That's where he first crossed paths with Earl Hamner, actually, who I think may have won. And they all met in New York City, where the show had sent them to get their prizes.
Mm-hmm. Well, then he went on to, right after he graduated from college, you know, he started his writing career, but he was at WLW I think it was in Cincinnati. He enjoyed radio, didn't he?
He did, but he got very frustrated because, again, he wanted to write meaningful scripts, you know, not testimonials for patent medicines. And he was also writing documentaries that honored the local towns, which his quote was, they had little to distinguish them except for their antiquity.
But he got some of that out now when he went into television, because he was writing in the 50s, mid-50s, for the Hallmark Hall of Fame, Kraft Theater, Playhouse 90. Those were some great anthology series. I have to imagine that's what kind of kicked things off for him.
But he was, you know, while he was a staff writer for WLW, he'd work all day at the studio, and then he'd go home and have a quick dinner and then write and write and write. And it was during that time that he had 40 rejections. In fact, someone even told him he should switch careers because he'd never be a writer.
Oh,
but I know, but he persevered, and Patterns in 1955 was his first really big hit. And at the time, my parents had a babysitter for my older sister. I wasn't born yet, and they told the babysitter, you know, nobody's going to call, don't worry about it. And he said that the minute the show went off the air, his phone started to ring.
But he certainly started making a name for himself in television and his writing as well.
Absolutely, right. Playhouse 90 and Kraft Theater.
Well, I'll tell you what, when we come back, we'll talk about The Twilight Zone and having a true television icon as a dad with Ann Serling next on 720 WGN. Stay player on 720 WGN, and we're talking to Ann Serling, daughter of TV legend Rod Serling, on the legacy of The Twilight Zone. So CBS purchased a teleplay in 1958, so this is a little bit before The Twilight Zone began. It's something your father wrote and hoped to produce as a pilot of a weekly series. It was called The Time Element. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, The Time Element was bought by CBS, and CBS shelved it for a year. And then it was bought by, I think his name was Bert Gannett, who worked for Desilu Studios. And because Bert was looking for good shows, and he wanted one of my dad's. And so they aired The Time Element, and I guess at the time it received more mail than any other show that Desilu Productions had aired that year.
Now, I think during this Desilu Playhouse, so even Desi Arnaz introduced the show. I mean, they were groundbreakers at the time, Desilu Productions. I think people forget it wasn't just I Love Lucy. They had some of the hottest dramas out there really in the 50s and the 60s.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Not many people knew that. And even, you know, I didn't even realize that until I was writing my book.
Now, CBS began talks then with your dad about producing The Twilight Zone, which is kind of where things started kicking off. The pilot was called, I think, Where Is Everybody?
Right. That he'd written something else that I can't at the moment recall the name of. I think it was called The Happy Place. Mm-hmm. But CBS felt it was too depressing or didn't really fit what they wanted to air. And so then he wrote the other one.
His writing for the series, you know, it was always mysterious. It was always full of drama, sometimes at the edgier seat, sometimes a little horror. But he always splashed in a little bit of humor in there. And really, when you were watching these shows, I think they were very relatable because they always somehow tied into real life and real life situations. And even though it would go off into a completely different turn, that's what made this series so exciting.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, again, he wanted to write meaningful scripts and relevant scripts. And because he'd had so much difficulty before The Twilight Zone, in fact, his quote was that an alien could say what a Democrat or a Republican couldn't. He wrote, like you said, relatable scripts and, you know, that dealt with social issues and moral issues. And you know, important things that are sadly still so relevant today.
Well, plus he wrote. Now, I mean, this is something else, too. When a series creator creates a show, I mean, they usually have a group of writers. He wrote like 2/3 of the series episodes for the entire run.
Yeah, there were 156 altogether, of which he wrote 92.
Wow.
And, you know, the other great writers were Earl Hamner and George Clayton Johnson and Matheson and
Ray Bradbury. I mean, the names were incredible.
Yeah, I think it was a pretty seamless team of writers, and they all got along, and it, yeah.
But I think that's what makes the, you know, when people talk about comedy, you know, the writers don't usually get its due. The actors do. When you talk about a classic comedy like a Dick Van Dyke Show or Andy Griffith or an I Love Lucy, you know, everyone talks about Lucy or Dick Van Dyke or Mary Tyler Moore or whatever. But when it comes to drama, and because there wasn't a steady actor in there, except for your father's presence in every show, you know, the writers really get the recognition. And I discovered it. It was airing on WGN in the late 70s, like at 10 o'clock at night, and I was a kid. I mean, I was maybe 10, 11 years old, and I've been hooked ever since. But, I mean, everything you see in this series, you know, the acting was great and everything else, but it's really one of the best-written shows in television history.
Well, thank you. And, again, my father would have been so surprised, you know, that the Writers Guild voted it one of the three top best shows a year ago. That he would have just been so honored and humbled by that.
Now, you know, what was the reason during the production, Anne, and I'm sure you've done your research on this, there were some episodes that were done on video instead of film. It's such a difference of quality. And one of them was the Art Carney Night of the Meek, their big Christmas episode. It was done like almost, it was very poor quality. Why did they do it at that point?
Well, apparently, you know, I didn't know this, of course, at the time, but apparently they switched because they for budget reasons, and they wanted to save money, and it was not a good idea by any means.
Yeah, it was six episodes. It was just six episodes for them. It was 22, Static, The Whole Truth, The Lateness of the Hour, The Night of the Meek, and Long Distance Call. And it just always surprised me when I saw those. Now, you said the original series contains 156 episodes. And unlike seasons 1 through 3 and 5, season 4 consisted of one-hour episodes. What kind of propelled your dad to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to do a full hour of this?
Well, I'm not certain that was actually his idea. I don't know, but I think that they, you know, eventually they returned to the 30-minute format because I think they thought that, you know, that worked better.
Did your dad have any favorite episodes? I mean, I know that's really hard, especially when you're writing almost 100 of them, of one of the most iconic television series. But did he have some favorites?
Well, I know that he liked Time Enough at Last and, you know, of course, Walking Distance and Willoughby. My dad said that he had a propensity to deal with sort of nostalgic themes. And certainly Walking Distance and Willoughby, you know, were, I think, two of the best ones as well.
Yeah, so one of my favorites was Willoughby as well, and then, and I just watched it the other day, is To Serve Man, which I thought was one of the creepiest episodes ever.
Right, yeah. Another one he wrote that Death had revisited about an SS officer who goes back to a concentration camp and gets his due, which I think was an extremely powerful episode.
But there was a ton of guest stars in these shows, too. I mean, people who really just got their television career started made appearances on The Twilight Zone.
Yeah, that's pretty stunning, isn't it? Robert Redford, you know, was one. James Dean. Several.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, the show was revived in 85 and 2002. And I got to tell you something. I'm the type of person that I cannot stand hearing about all these reboots. It's the latest trend in Hollywood that you're seeing more and more of. They're rebooting this movie. They're rebooting this television show. Isn't there an original idea that's out there? And I know it's an anthology series. So if you've got some great writers that will write in the tradition of your father, I guess I get that. The one they did in 85, I think, was there were some great stories in there as well. But you know what? There's something to be said for, you know, holding on to, you know, that original show and the original writing and the quality of that program.
I couldn't agree with you more, Dave. Where is the originality? Where is the creativity today? You know, it was said that what was missing from those reboots was Rod Serling.
Right.
And in truth, I didn't watch them because it kind of disturbed me, the whole idea of bringing it all back without him. But
I bet. Now, The Twilight Zone, the movie, It was produced by Steven Spielberg, Dan Aykroyd, Albert Brooks, John Lithgow, Vic Morrow, Scatman Crothers. There were three classic episodes remaining here. That one, I must admit, I enjoyed it, but it was because they were the original episodes from the series.
Right, but you know they took license with the, or that's not the word I'm looking for. It's a Good Life, that one. I think, you know, they sort of bastardized that one. And I was, in all honesty, disappointed by the movie for all the reasons we were just talking about. Yeah. You know, it's very difficult to redo something that was so extraordinary in its time.
The Twilight Zone, Anne, was such a success story. What was your dad's feelings about the development and moderate success of his second show, Night Gallery?
You know, I think initially he had great aspirations for it, but unlike The Twilight Zone, he did not have creative control over Night Gallery, and it turned out to be a tremendous disappointment for him. That said, there were some great episodes. They're Tearing Down Tim Riley's Bar was, I think, a beautiful script, and one of my dad's favorites, and one that was nominated for an Emmy as well. Again, dealing with the theme of going back in time.
He was so young when he passed away at 50, and you were so young. You were only 20 years old. Is that what inspired you to write the book about your father? Were there other books written about him that you were not happy with? Did you just want to, was this book kind of in your heart for so long, and you just wanted to be able to tell that story?
Well, originally, a few years after my dad died, I started writing. I tried to novelize the story, called In His Absence. But I was still trying to navigate that whole minefield of grief, and I was barely, you know, coping at that point, even years later. And then I finally decided to write as I knew him for three reasons. One was because I find writing cathartic, as my dad did. I also wanted to know more about his professional life. And also there had been biographies, quote-unquote, written about my father that so incensed me because they were really fallacious accounts, and they described a man that was not remotely familiar to me, sort of this dark, tortured soul, and that wasn't who my father was. And so I seized the opportunity to set the record straight.
Well, I love that you did that. The book is a really wonderful read, and takes you really behind the man behind all this wonderful work, and your relationship with him as well. Wonderful book.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you so much.